Welcome back to the Anaheim Calling Podcast. Take two of tonight's show, Sunday night here. The Anaheim Ducks taking on the San Jose Sharks, losing this one 6-2 in what was kind of a bizarre game, which we will get into. We apologize to those who were in the Mixler chat just now. We had some technical difficulties, but we're running it back, and I think we have the issue all sorted out. So, we're good to go, but let's get into the game. So before we had to abort the first take of this show, we were talking about, and just so everyone knows, we didn't really talk about anything else. We were pretty early into the show.
We made it like five minutes.
Yeah, exactly. But basically tonight's game, I'm going to have to assume that no one heard anything we had said before here. Tonight's game, the Ducks lose 6-2. It was a pretty big game standings-wise. Tail end of the week where the Ducks played four games. Really, you would have liked to see the Ducks come out with a win tonight, especially, you know, against a divisional opponent. Not to be, but Jake, you were perhaps on an island here in Ducks Nation saying that Anaheim played a lot better than meets the eye, at least on the scoreboard tonight.
Yeah, I definitely feel like I'm on that island right now. Everyone on Twitter, I mean, I get it. You lose 6-2, the score line's big. You want to say they didn't show up, they didn't bring their A game in a big divisional game with a big couple of points on the line, 4-point swing actually. But you kind of dive into the numbers and you look at that first period, you look at everything, it wasn't that bad of a game. If you take out the undisciplined penalties that they took and the allowing some of the penalty power play goals, which we'll probably get into as we kind of get more along here, but it wasn't a bad performance. They had a really great first period and then probably a more even second and third period with what is a good Sharks team. We need to take into some consideration that the other team is also there and also playing and will kind of step up their game. And so it was an even second and third period, and they deserve probably better than a 6-2 scoreline. And I think that that's kind of what I like to focus on with this, at least, and kind of if you play this game again, and I know I've said this a couple times, but if you play this game another 10 times, the Ducks probably win the majority of these games. If they play like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, especially in that first period, which we'll just jump into right here. The Ducks edge the Sharks in shot attempts at 5-on-5 in that first period. By the way, a period that was mostly played at 5-on-5, which would turn out to be a problem for the Ducks later on in the game. But the Ducks edge the Sharks 25-14 in shot attempts, high danger scoring chances 6-2. So the Ducks playing a real solid brand of hockey in that first period. I thought that the line of Adam Henrique, Andre Kasha, and Nick Ritchie looked really good once again. And just right off the bat, I mean, Ricard Raquel with a really gets a breakaway from a really nice feed by Corey Perry just down the gut, springs him for a breakaway. Throws a forehand, backhand move on Sharks goalie Aaron Dell, who slides across and makes a really nice blocker save. Aaron Dell, by the way, has been playing well this season, and Martin Jones, I believe, recently injured and who has struggled mightily this season, even going back to last year. So some goalie controversy going on in San Jose that I'm sure was only exacerbated tonight with Aaron Dell basically stealing the game for the Sharks. I thought that if Aaron Dell isn't standing on his head in that first period, you probably see a Ducks lead instead of what would turn out to be the Sharks being up 1-0 at the end of the first on a goal by Mark Edward Vlasic and what was kind of a broken play off the rush. I believe Tomas Hertl tries to thread the needle, and the puck kind of just gets lost in Francois Beauchemin's skates, who loses sight of Mark Edward Vlasic, who gets left all alone in front to score. So just kind of a bizarre play.
Kind of a
lack of attention to detail by Beauchemin there. But with Aaron Dell's strong play, you factor that in, and the Sharks are up 1-0 going to the first intermission.
Yeah, and one thing I want to mention about that first period is kind of, as I was saying and as we were both saying, how dominant they were. And kind of there is kind of one negative that I do want to focus on with this is that it seemed like every line had it going and were getting chances besides the Kessler line. And the fourth line got chances. Henrique's line got chances. Getzloff line did get chances. The Kessler line, I think, was the only line where the majority of the players on it were below 50% in Corsi 4 percentage during that period when I kind of looked it up at the intermission. And they also did not see the better side of, I think, the scoring chance battle in that period. And so that's kind of something of note that when you have this shut down mine, they're not doing a good job of doing that.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. And you look at you dip into the numbers here a little bit, and it appears that the Ryan Kesler line with Silverberg and Cogliano was hard matched against the line of Tomas Hertl, Logan Couture, and Kevin LeBanc. And Couture especially has been really good for the Sharks this year. Kevin LeBanc would eventually score, but that's a good line right there. Not like necessarily an elite line, but it's right up there. And so they were tasked with that. Also tasked mainly with matching up against the pairing of Brent Burns and Joakim Ryan. Although I'm not sure if that's exactly a pairing. It might be Vlasic and Burns. But either way, I mean, that's some tough competition right there, which typically this line finds a way to come out on top of, but not to be tonight. Let's get into the second period here. So a couple of interesting things that I wanted to note. Basically, right after that first goal, the Ducks come right back and get a scoring chance, kind of like how they had been doing the entire first period. So that gave you some confidence going to the second period. But shortly into that middle period, Kevin LeBanc, who we just mentioned, comes down the wing. And I'm not exactly sure how this play happened. I mean, really, just Kevin LeBanc kind of used his speed to get down the wing. I think Anaheim may have been just coming off of a line change, but
yeah,
comes down the right wing as a right-handed shot. Throws on a little leg kick to kind of fake the shot. Gibson doesn't bite on that fake, but what LeBanc does right after he does that is he pushes the puck out just a little bit, changes the angle of that shot, and just roofs it into the top of the net, short side, glove side. If you're John Gibson, you want to make that save. I mean, a right-handed shot on the right side, there's just not a whole lot of angle there. But it was a really nice shot and a really nice play, and maybe on most nights, John Gibson makes that save, and that would kind of become the trend of tonight's game, is that nice goals by the Sharks, but on a lot of nights, especially this season, John Gibson is probably stopping those.
Yeah, and on that goal, just kind of on the play leading up to it, I have kind of a good recollection of what happened. There was kind of a nice rush going into that play. I can't remember what forward line was out there, but Hampus Lindholm had jumped up into the play and gets a nice little chance, but gets a stick lift right in the slot, and the Sharks turn it the other way, and so whatever forward was supposed to be high covering for Lindholm wasn't there. And all while this is going on, Manson saw the opportunity with the puck being in the other zone to make a change. What happens there is LeBanc gets it up the far boards. Closest D-man would have been the guy that just jumped onto the ice, which I believe was Francois Beaujolais. And he had just jumped on the ice from the bench. So he was pretty far away from that play.
A little bit of a bizarre play there.
Or it may have been Fowler, but still, regardless. It was just kind of like a bit of a broken play, bad timing. And I think it's one that Gibson, I think he kind of hit the nail on the head. It's probably one that he makes most nights. And that might be the story of this game.
Yeah, I mean, the Ducks not really getting the goaltending, and not, especially after the first period. What really killed the Ducks in this game was a lack of discipline, which we will get into. A lot of consternation, by the way, in this game about a few slashing penalties early on. Some that went against the Sharks, by the way. I think I saw you tweeting about this, but I thought they were all pretty obvious slashes. I mean, I know that maybe they're a little ticky-tack, but, I mean, one, Beauchemin knocks the guy's stick out of his hands.
See, I'm not a fan of that.
Yeah, but but that's the rule, though. I mean, no, you knock a guy's stick out of his... That's how I've seen it interpreted, at least.
It depends on which referee. 100% okay. Depends on, because I've seen it called that way. I've majority of the time, what you see is if the stick breaks, then that's an automatic call. And then if the stick doesn't break, it's usually not. Most of the time it's fair game, because you stick check a guy. And so what if here's just kind of what I'll throw at you, and not saying that this is what the Sharks were doing, but what if a guy, for whatever reason, doesn't have the strongest grip on a stick whatever position he's in, gets his stick slashed, comes out. That slash doesn't necessarily have that much force. Is that still a slashing penalty because he knocked it out of the guy's hand? To me, no. It's the same stick check that you see all the time. And even on that note, I even despise the fact that because a stick breaks, it's a slashing call. I think really the only thing that the stick in my mind should be fair game, unless you're talking about like a two-hand overhead lumberjack chop.
See, I actually, and this is kind of a pet peeve of mine from playing hockey, but I hate when guys come down on my stick. It's one of my biggest pet peeves. First of all, those things are expensive.
Yes, secondly, agreed.
I just don't think there's any skill in that. Like, there's no skill in just hacking at a guy's stick. Like, it's...
No, but
this is, I don't know.
But we bring up tying up a guy's stick and all the stuff and lifting his stick. I'm talking about just slashing it to knock his stick off. To knock him off.
No, I just think if you come down on a guy's stick, and this is not going off the rule book, I just think if you come down on a guy's stick like that, like, to me, that's a slash. Like, you're slashing at his stick. Fair. Like, this, I don't know. Keep in mind, I have a huge pet peeve towards this. So
that's fair. I think at the end of the day, my biggest frustration is that not all referees call that specific play the same way. There's no standard, it seems like, that the league has. I'm completely fine with there were a couple calls. There was one on Henrique where he caught the hand. 100% fine.
Like, that one was obvious.
Yeah, you catch the hands, that should be a slash. But it's just like someone needs to set the standard of, if you come down from on top and knock the stick out of a guy's hand, and that's a slashing call, fine. But make sure it's called every time, and that is the standard we go with moving forward. Because as of right now, certain referees will call that, certain referees won't.
Yeah, no, I mean, I agree with you there, the consistency. But just to illustrate how much I despise that play, in one of my games when I was playing in school, we were playing, I think, Arizona State or whatever, and we hated that team, by the way, so shout out to anyone listening who went to Arizona State, but their roller hockey team is not the nicest of folk. But the guy comes down on my stick like three times, and I got so frustrated that I grabbed the guy's stick and threw it across the rink and grabbed it out of his hands. And so definitely got a penalty on that play. But anyway, just to reveal my bias a little here, let's move on. No one wants to hear about my hockey stories here. Let's move on to the rest of this period. So a little quick note here, since we're still on JT Brown watch. I thought Brown had one little nice pass to Ryan Getzlaff, a little bank pass to kind of lead him down the ice on the penalty kill. So JT Brown tonight, by the way, hardly played 9 minutes total tonight.
Hey, that's
single digits.
That's a lot for a Carlisle fourth line.
Yeah, but what I would like to point out is that I believe halfway through the third period, he was at 5 minutes. So they basically just rolled him out for like those last,
that's
quote unquote garbage time.
That's
way, like that's not a lot. I mean, Vermette and Wagner played 11 and 10 minutes each. So the fourth line not seeing a lot of ice, which, you know, I don't have a huge problem with, but it is something to note. Ducks' first power play, I thought, we'll get into this more at the end of the first period, the end of the second period, but looked okay. Not nearly as threatening as against LA on Friday and against Pittsburgh on Wednesday. But I did think that still that first unit looked okay. And then the second unit, man,
it was painful.
I mean, just end the power play when those guys get out there because it is bad.
It was so painful. I think I made a similar note to you that it was just like, or note on Twitter or somewhere. That it was painful. They couldn't do anything. The first unit created so much, they didn't create so much, but still they created something.
I mean, they're in the zone. They're making plays. It looks like they're on the power play. So, third goal from the Sharks here would come on another one of those bizarre plays. And again, lack of discipline from Anaheim, to the penalty kill once again. Mikhail Bodker, kind of unfettered in the offensive zone, just shoots it far side on Gibson, who's completely screened by Timo Meier. And this would become a bit of a theme in tonight's game. I thought that the Sharks were able to screen Gibson, and he wasn't fighting that hard to see around them, but no one was really clearing out either. And I think on both of those plays, it was Cam Fowler, the one we'll get into later. Or was it Lindholm?
It was Lindholm on the first one.
Yeah. But either way, it's like I'm having a hard time understanding. I know that teams tend to sometimes leave the guy in front alone, but, I mean, Gibson couldn't see anything on that goal especially.
Yeah, and this was something I was going to bring up, and maybe we can talk about it now as compared to later, but after that, the other goal that happens very similarly, but it almost seems like it was a strategy by the defensive structure to kind of, because we have two goals that happen in a very similar fashion with the guy in front of the net, and no one's even, Lindholm and, it's not like Lindholm and Fowler are off guarding another guy. They're both standing right there. and neither of them are engaging. And it's almost as if the structure is to not engage there.
Right.
Let deal with the rebound, basically, is kind of where they're at. And it's just, it seems strange to me.
Yeah. I mean, I know that there are teams, like, I know that that's a thing. They'll just leave the guy in front alone and worry about, like, the passing lanes or whatever. But I feel like there has to be some circumstances where it's like, all right, our goalie can't see anything. We probably want to clear this guy out. So tough to maybe blame the individual players on those plays, because it could be, like you said, a system thing. But optics of it, not very good, which is something that would continue to be a theme in that game. So to the power play we go to end that second period. The Ducks get a 5-on-3. I believe the initial penalty might have... No, it wasn't a bench minor. It was something else.
It was too many men.
It was a bench minor, and then was it the slash by Joe Pavelski? Yes, that made it a two-man advantage?
That was not a slash. He caught the hands. That was the exact same play that Hemrink got called for. He caught he caught Fowler's hands. Maybe I'm being biased here and being a homer, but to me, Pavelski reaches, catches Fowler's hands. Based on the standards that they had set in that game, that's a penalty.
Right.
And I think that's the key.
Within the game, it was understandable, but I don't know.
I get what you're saying to put a team down to 5-on-3 based on that's kind of hard, but I think because you've called that consistently throughout the game, you have to make that call.
Right, which is totally fair. The Ducks go to the power play, though, and not really getting much of anything going. I mean, a lot of weird just kind of plays, not really much fluidity, which is something that honestly was a shock to me, because I know that, you know, maybe the Sharks are a better penalty kill or whatever, but the way that you've been seeing this first unit click in the last few games, you would think, okay, 5-on-3, they're really going to go to town. And instead, you know, settling for shots from the perimeter that don't really have any chance of going in, no screens in front. I mean, the whole idea when you're on a 5-on-3 is to get as close as you can to the net and basically try to get a tap-in or a one-timer. That's something that they were kind of doing earlier in the game, too, just taking shots from far out.
Well, and I feel like, I mean, going back to earlier in the game, there was that one moment in the first period where one of the Sharks broke his stick and the Ducks were just kind of, they held on to the puck for a long time trying to work for a shot, but it was just, the puck wasn't getting anywhere below the faceoff dots, and that's kind of how this 5-on-3 felt also, and it was almost like it wasn't like they were looking for the perfect play, because when you're looking for the perfect play, you still have movement, you're trying to make your passes. Everyone was just kind of stagnant, and I think that's the biggest issue, is that when you're on a power play and you're on a 5-on-3, you take advantage of that extra man by getting some movement and causing some confusion and making some matchup issues, and if you're standing still, you're making it easier for the penalty killers to defend it. And that's kind of what the Ducks did there. And, I mean, they got a break and a bounce. But it's not what you want to see on a 5-on-3.
Yes, yeah, so you beat me to it there. But Ricard Raquel gets his 17th goal of the season on just kind of a broken play. He's on the right side of the net, tries to center it across. And I'm forgetting the guy who it deflected off of. But basically, yes, it goes off of Vlasic's stick or skate and deflects right into the net. So a broken play that results in a goal. The Ducks obviously will take it. That puts the game at 3-1. Going to the third, you're feeling kind of good at that point. It's like, all right, you know, there's at least some momentum here. There's life, yeah. And like we said, you know, the Ducks had looked generally good, kind of got mired in these penalties in the second period. But, you know, it's like, all right, there's a sign of life here. Third period starts. And a real strong shift, actually, from that Ryan Kessler line, I thought, to start the third period at least. But then, building off of that momentum, a really nice kind of just dump in by Josh Manson, hard around the wall. Andre Kasha recovers it behind the net. I'm pretty sure Manson saw Kasha kind of streaking in on that left wing. Kasha gets the puck and delivers a very nice, almost like a no-look backhand pass to Ryan Getzlaff, who just roofs it short side on a one-timer. So a really nice play at that point, and that makes the game a one-goal game. And at that point, you're thinking, all right, we've got a hockey game. Didn't really turn out to be the case,
Nope. And I think we should make a note that the Ducks had put Kasha, elevated him off the third line and put him onto that top line with Getzlaff. And that's something that kind of we've talked about a bit on
It's been sneakily like the the topic we've spent the most time on this week.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, I mean, not to toot our own horns, but it was working. And I don't think that a lot of people, and I'll get into this a bit at the end, a lot of people got on Perry's case in this game and thought he was invisible.
As they tend to do.
Yeah, as it happens. But I kind of see this and just kind of look at that as being almost the structuring of the lines working better with him on the Henrique line and Kasha up there. And it's not any disrespect to Perry or anything that I think Kasha's better. I just think it's the line combination, I think, works better. And I think when you have Raquel and Perry there, you kind of have two of the same type of players there, and it doesn't exactly work. Whereas if you throw Kasha, you have a guy that's going to be able to go in on the forecheck, and kind of we have case in point right there on that goal. That
exactly, yeah, that's like to a T.
Exactly what's going to happen. And I think that Henrique kind of can do that on his own, and Richie, to a certain extent, can also do that. So kind of being able to take Kasha off that line and put him on a line that needs that type of player is a much better use of the talent and much better distribution of the talent throughout the lineup to set up your lines and have better depth. And so I think that maybe this would be a good look moving forward. But, yeah, I think we can get more into that later.
We've talked about it quite a bit. And, you know, it's not just that we're not trying to beat a dead horse here. It's just it obviously when they go to it, it works. And I think the real issue here isn't so much that they don't think it works, because clearly, I mean, they do go to it. It's just they got to find a spot for Corey Perry that makes sense for him. Mm-hmm. And as long as they can't figure that out, you're going to keep seeing Perry and Kasha kind of flipping between the first and third lines. So it's funny. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, if you want to, I can jump into this real quick about Perry, just because there was something interesting on that, because a lot of people thought he was invisible or any of that type of stuff. So I was like,
well, he wasn't very noticeable tonight.
I disagree with that to an extent. If you look at just shot attempt numbers,
right.
He had 4 individual shot attempts, 4 individual scoring chances, 2 individual high danger chances, 3 shots on goal. He created a couple chances for Raquel in that first period.
I mean, he almost scored.
He almost scored right off the faceoff with Henrique. He had that pass from Getzloff that barely went off them. I think there are those plays, and I'll say this is frustrating, where on the zone entry, he tries to attack guys like he used to, and he just can't get around them like he used to. And so maybe that type of play kind of sits in people's head and makes them think he's invisible or he's turning the puck over. And yes, that does happen, and yes, that's frustrating. But I think if we isolate kind of his overall game tonight, or kind of look at the overall game, he wasn't bad, and he wasn't an issue. He was fine. He got his chances, and in a season where we've both been critical of him for not shooting the puck, he shot the puck tonight. So people, if that's been their main complaint with him this season, tonight should be should not be a night you focus on him.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm starting to lean a little towards the Corey Perry is struggling side of this.
Mm-hmm.
But it's funny how the narratives work, right? I mean, he receives that pass from Getzlaff that goes wide. And if that puck goes in, everyone's like, oh, Corey Perry's playing great. That puck goes wide instead, and people are saying, oh, Corey Perry's struggling. Really just a matter of that puck going in.
Or if Raquel buries the chance in the first period that Perry kind of fed it to him from out of the corner, Raquel buries that, you're like, oh, that's a great, great pass for a goal. But it's almost as if because the goal doesn't happen, those types of plays kind of end up in the back of your mind and you don't fully remember them. Exactly. And that's kind of,
go ahead. Sorry.
Oh no. I was just going to say, I think that's where kind of advanced stats and these types of newfound statistics that we both like so much kind of come into play, because up until we had those, all you could really rely on are goals, assists, and points. And those are such isolated plays within a game that, yes, they matter. Yes, obviously they are the ones that determine the outcome of the game, but those can't tell you how a guy played fully on the night. A guy could play great and still score a goal, and you could look at his overall performance and be like, he probably should have played better on the night.
Right.
But he scored, so I just think this is really a time where we can kind of look at these stats and be able to dive into them a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough because with Perry, you know, the big point of contention is that he makes all that money, you know, and it's like, well, if you're going to be the highest paid player, you know, I just think Max Pacioretty is like this a lot in Montreal, where obviously a goal scorer and literally every goal scorer that's ever lived is streaky. No one scores every game. And so he'll go through these dry spells and people will be all over him in Montreal. They will be, you know, the stories come out about this and that, and you know, the sky is falling down. And then right now I think he's on a 6-game goal scoring streak or something like that. And all of a sudden the narrative flips, right? And look how great, look how hard he's working, the, you know, so of course, like, the, it's always a bit of, I guess, ad hoc analysis. But I do think, though, that in Corey Perry's, you know, circumstance here, yeah, the numbers don't look bad by any means, but I'm not seeing him playing the way he even played in the beginning of the season. Like, because I know he's not the same player he was 5 years ago.
Yeah, like, I think that's not a fair comparison to previous
seasons. Every player, like, that's kind of where a lot of this is stemming from, is that people want him to be Rocky Richard, Corey Perry.
That's true.
He's not that anymore. But if I'm even comparing him to games 1 through 17 or whatever, like, he doesn't seem as involved in the offense. He doesn't seem like he's kind of, maybe it's because Getzlaff is back, and maybe I got so accustomed to seeing Perry kind of having the puck more on a stick. But I don't know. I'm just not seeing him make the same kind of plays. We got some construction going on in the podcast.
I think my fiance is trying to do some interior decorating as I'm recording. So sorry about that, guys.
Well, it's like the PDO cast with the drilling. So it's okay. We're
the sirens.
This is how we know that we're hitting mainstream status, as we have construction work in the background.
We need that. We need some sirens going.
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
We had technical We had technical difficulties. We're on par with Merrick versus Wyshynski.
Yes. So. Yes. Exactly. We're just doing our best here. But let's move this along, because we've beaten this Corey Perry thing to death a little bit. Although it is funny, because just one last thing on Perry. Listener Steve Hawking, we were chatting on Twitter earlier, and he just asks me out of nowhere, do you still think someone would claim Perry if he was able to be put on waivers right now? And I'm like, well, you know, like, I know people are down on him, but come on. Like, I think a lot of teams would still want Corey Perry. I'm sure you have some thoughts on that.
Sorry, one more time.
Were you addressing some? Yes. Well, all I was saying was that listener Steve Hawking we were messaging earlier, and he asked me, do you still think someone would claim Perry if he was able to be put on waivers right now? And I was like, well, I know he's not playing at his best, but come on, there's still a lot of teams that would like him on his team.
There's still a lot of value there. Like, if for us to say, yeah, it, I mean, yeah, I got nothing, because it's just, to me, it would make zero sense for a whole bunch of reasons. Maybe someone does. Maybe no one claims him because of his contract. Who knows? But
right. But that would be the only thing. Like, I mean, he's still Corey Perry. Like, yeah. I don't know. I just think there's a lot of teams that would want him.
Yeah.
We have some funny comments in the Mixler chat right now. GC Ducks fan, getting old sucks. You know, talking about this Corey Perry aging curve thing. Today I popped my back while I was holding my cat. Almost didn't make the game. So, GC, I hope that your back is okay. I hope your cat is okay. But yeah, that doesn't sound great. that, man. I'm still relatively young, I guess. So I hopefully my back doesn't give out while I'm holding my cat when I'm older. We'll see. Happy wife, happy life, Jake. You get that one?
Yeah, I got that one
from Shash One.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure she's putting up one of my pictures also. So I guess I can't complain that much.
Yeah, you're in a tough spot here.
I got a solid comeback on Catella poster for the holidays. So. I'm pretty sure she's putting that up somewhere in the apartment. So
very nice. All right.
Yeah.
Let's wrap up this third period here, because it will be not fun. If you're a Ducks fan here, you might want to cover your ears for the next 5 minutes. I wouldn't want you to do that, but you might have to. A lot of goals went in for the Ducks in a brief span. Right after the Getzlaff makes it 3-2, bringing the Ducks within one. Joe Thornton, I believe, yes, this was in the power play once again. Cam Fowler leaves Pavelski kind of untouched in front to screen John Gibson. Joe Thornton, of all people, shot the puck. I mean, it never happens. But wires a slap shot that goes post and in, far side. Another one of those goals where it's like, man, maybe if John Gibson battles a little harder to see that puck, maybe he makes a save. But it was basically a perfect shot from Joe Thornton.
Yeah.
And then another goal right after that, or soon after, to make it 5-2 San Jose. Brandon Montour kind of whiffs on a one-timer in the offensive zone and just kind of basically goes flying after he, like, loses an edge or whatever. That leads to a Sharks 3-on-1 going back the other way. And, I mean, this I'm going to say this was a bad goal on Gibson. Mikhail Bodker has the puck on that 3-on-1 on the left side. And, honestly, like, I know he was wide open. I know it was a 3-on-1. But Gibson was playing him very square to the shooter. And just kind of fires, honestly, like a softball, just like a muffin, as they would say. Mm-hmm. And it goes right under Gibson's arm and into the net. And at that point, you know, the game is already kind of out of reach. I mean, well, I don't know. It was, I guess, a 4-2 game at that point. But that just kind of puts it out of reach right there. And Gibson would eventually get pulled. That has to be, it might not be the first time this season, but we haven't seen too much of that this season, and I didn't think that was a particularly good goal against Gibson.
No, it goes between the arm and the body, and it's not exactly one that he's given up a whole lot this season. And, I mean, that goal actually made it 5-2-2, because there was the
yes, penalty. That made it 5-2, yeah.
That made it 5-2, so that was basically game over right there. So, I don't know, there's been so many games this season where we can point as Gibson being the reason they won. Maybe this is the one game we'll kind of look back on and be like, he may be the reason they lost the points in this game. So, hasn't happened
absolutely
often.
Absolutely, yeah.
Hasn't happened often this season, but no goalie is going to have a perfect season. There are going to be some games like this.
The guys didn't really bury it early on the other side of the ice, so nothing really clicking there. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, you know, we have to be fair. When I'm not, like, typically I try to find ways, I mean, as a former goalie, I try to find ways to not
protecting
blame the goalie.
Your other goalies.
I got to look out for the, you know, it's the goalies union. But, you know, sometimes goalies do have, like, obviously bad games. And I'm not sure I would label this as a bad game from John Gibson, but I just don't think he really made his team any better tonight. I think he was just kind of there, maybe hurting their chances slightly. But, you know, like, in fairness to John Gibson and the season he's had, he's pretty much the only reason the Ducks are even in the position they're in right now to be in these games where they could potentially jump into a playoff spot. So we have to be fair to John Gibson. Ryan Miller comes in relief, and sure enough, just wasn't a good night for any of the Ducks goalies. Melker Carlson comes down the wing. I believe it was off of a line change for the Ducks. I was kind of trying to figure out why I had so much space. But anyway, doesn't really matter. Makes the game 6-2. A slap shot from the wing that beats Miller, and honestly was, again, that was not Guy Lafleur coming down the wing. Let's just put it that way. Game is 6-2. At that point, it's over. We see a little bit of Andre Kasha with Getzlaff and Jakob Silverberg to end the period, but that's pretty much all she wrote for tonight's game. So yeah, I mean, the Ducks play an okay game, but to me, have just enough brain farts and don't get the goaltending, and against a very focused Sharks team, drop it 6-2. And now the Ducks are kind of back in that heap with the Wild, Avalanche, and the Kings for that final wild card spot with 53 points, tied with the Kings, but they're now 2 points back of the final wild card, final wild card spot, 2 points back of the Flames for the third spot in the division. So that's good for the Ducks, but the Sharks now pulling away with 58 points, 5 points ahead of the Ducks in the second Pacific Division spot. So the Ducks aren't out of it by any means after tonight, but a win would have certainly gone a long way.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And I think kind of we need to, if we look big picture, just at the homestand in general, they're now 2-1 on this homestand with two more games. I think if you want to have a chance to be in the race, you gotta take at least one out of the next two to come out of the homestand being, what would that make it? That would be 4 wins and 2 losses on the homestand. I think realistically, the best case scenario obviously is going to be 5 out of 6 on the homestand for a possible 10 out of 12 points. Scoreboard update from at GC Ducks fan. Kings are currently up 3-2 against the Rangers.
Uh-oh. And the Ducks play the Rangers Tuesday. So.
yeah, and I think Paulette brings up a good point on this game specifically, that every point counts specifically against Western Conference teams ahead of you. I agree with that. I think we're still at a point in the season. I think we focus so heavily on how important that Kings game was, but there is still some time left. You're not going to win every single game against the team ahead of you. The Ducks have done a good job in the last little bit of beating those teams. I think that a loss maybe, I don't know if it was coming, but it shouldn't have been that unexpected. I don't know. I don't know really.
Let's kind of zoom out also. I mean, the Ducks have gotten points in 7 of their last 10 games. So this is a team that's, you know, been rolling along pretty well.
I was just going to say, even then, 2 of those games that they didn't get points on or points in, they didn't play necessarily bad in. And I think that's, that's at the end of the day where I was trying to get at, I think, is that we're still at kind of a midpoint of the season where, yes, you need to be picking up points. But if over a 10-game stretch you can look back and say, no, we didn't play a bad game anywhere, that's a good sign, and especially if you're picking up points in 7 of those 10 games.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, look, they're humming along. You know, they are behind the 8-ball.
Yes.
That's the thing, is even if you're playing well, they're just in a position where they really can't drop too many of these games, especially against a team like the Sharks.
Yeah. And we have a couple of questions in the Mixler chat. From Shatch1 brought up that the Ducks have no finishers or elite shooters, lots of great playmakers, but no finishers. Kind of said the Sharks have finishers in Bodker, Pavelski, Hurdle, Couture. I'm going to push back pretty hard on that. Mikhail Bodker is not that great of a finisher.
Oh, he's Pavelski, not good.
He's not good. Pavelski is great at tipping the puck. I don't think Hurdle or Couture have had, maybe I'm wrong on this, I haven't really looked this up, but I don't think either of them are that elite finishers. The Ducks have solid finishers. Silverberg has put up goals. Raquel has put up goals in the past. Perry even should probably end up, my money would say he'll probably end up around the 20-goal range on the season. I just don't think that that's really exactly warranted. I think the Ducks have plenty of scoring. They have plenty of depth. I think this is one of the deeper rosters that they've had in a long, long time. So, yeah. Just kind of my take on that. I don't know if you disagree with me or not.
I'd agree with you offensively. I think that their depth is great, but man,
yeah,
I would like to point out that if I can get the number here, that tonight Kevin Bieksa played nearly 21 minutes. Not gonna win too many games
why
with Kevin Bieksa
like
playing
that
much.
Why you have to hurt me like that?
In the great words of former 49ers coach Mike Singletary, not going to be able to do it. Like, can't do it with that. I also wanted to bring something up here, since that's quite the depressing topic. I'm not sure if this is any more or less depressing, but we've had a lot of consternation around what will this team look like when fully healthy? What will we see? You know, because a lot of people have been quick to reject all the data that the Ducks have, you know, kind of accumulated so far because of the fact that, you know, I mean, I think it's fair. There's been a lot of injuries yep. to the most important pieces of the roster. So a little snapshot here. Since Christmas, which is kind of my little arbitrary time frame here, but it's kind of when I think Getzlaf and Kessler basically came back.
Yeah.
The Ducks have a 47.8% Corsi. And a 52.55 expected goals for percentage. And that is writing a kind of so-so PDO. I mean, the save percentage is still very high. Shooting percentage, not quite so high. But this fits a lot more with the team that I saw last year.
Yes.
I mean, they're also getting, wow, this is insane. Since December 27th, the Ducks at 5-on-5, 58.8 goals for percentage. Oh my goodness. I mean, I don't think that all of that is, I don't know how real that is, but you are seeing an uptick in this team's game.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that, I mean, what'd you say their expected goals for percentage was at? Was it 52 or 54, somewhere in that range?
It is at 52.55 since Christmas time.
Yeah.
Which is so really good, by the way.
So it's not as if they're real, I mean, 4 or 5%. They're outperforming their expected goals for percentage, but not excessively. Let's go with that. So I think that's a good sign to begin with. And I'd say one thing that Pollock kind of brings up is, yes, Kessler came back in the lineup after Christmas, but it seemed like it took him a while to get his legs back underneath him. And
yeah, absolutely. He was not himself the first few games.
No, and it really kind of feels like since the bye week has ended, the team's really kind of, they've had that uptick, basically. They've started to play more like what we all expected. They've been having much better performances top to bottom throughout games. They've had some lulls here and there, but overall it's been solid game after solid game after solid game.
Yeah, I will definitely agree with that. I mean, look, we all knew the beginning of the season, you can only kind of take it with a grain of salt with all the injuries. But now, you know, you look at these numbers, and to me, they definitely more closely resemble the team that we saw last year. Because, you know, the Ducks last year, shot attempts, never a strong suit, but expected goals definitely better in that department, and we're kind of starting to see that arise again. So, look, things are looking up for the Ducks. The issue is that, I mean, they're just in this precarious position in the standings where every loss just sets you back a little bit, and they're going to have to keep playing this way.
Yep, and I think it can't be just a stretch. It has to be a lot of, basically the rest of the season. Because that's kind of the thing, is you look at teams that have gone on really extreme winning stretches. I mean, look at Colorado, as you would say, my Lanch.
Your Lanch.
What is it? They're on a 10-game winning streak, and where are they currently at in the standings? They are barely in a playoff spot.
They're scratching for that last spot, yeah.
So, I mean, you go on a 10-game winning streak and you're only barely in the playoffs, like, it's hard to make a ground in this league.
It's really tough with so many teams ahead. And, you know, we talked about this when the Ducks were kind of struggling a lot more at the beginning of the season. But, you know, those games in hand, I mean, Colorado has 3 games in hand on the Ducks, which is insane. I guess a little bye week playing into it there. The Kings have 2 games in hand on the Ducks. The Sharks have 2 games right in hand. Yeah. Oh, the Kings are playing right now. But those games in hand definitely don't work in Anaheim's favor. Right now, the Ducks' playoff odds, according to MoneyPuck.com, which make what you will of their probabilities, but they're at 27.44%. So, I mean, not out of it, but like it's a puncher's chance right now more than anything.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. So you want to move on? We've got a couple questions.
Yes, we do have a couple of questions some good ones here if you want to get into those.
So at GC Ducks fan brings up, with the trade deadline coming, the fourth period reported that Anaheim have interest in Evander Kane, Thomas Vanek, Mike Hoffman, Max Pacioretty, and Michael Grabner. Your thoughts? So basically everyone on the market.
Yeah, they went to tsn.ca/hockey, pulled up, you know, trade deadline.
Google, wingers who are available on the trade trade market. Good.
Oh man, I like that. Yeah, I mean, keep in mind here, guys, that, look, all I will say is that the fourth period last summer reported that Sammy Vatanen was being traded was part of a package being sent to the Vegas Golden Knights. So the fourth period definitely has sources around the league, but take it with a semi grain of salt. It's not, it's not Bob McKenzie reporting that. I mean, I would assume that the Ducks do have interest in one of those guys at least. But I don't know that, what are they basically saying there? Like, yeah, the Ducks want a good player at the trade deadline.
And all I've kind of seen really in kind of looking at different websites for rumors is a lot of people are just kind of saying the Ducks have interest in bringing in a winger. And so I think that all those guys do fit that bill. I think if we want to break down each one briefly on who I'd want and who I wouldn't, I'd want
Evander Kane. You want to run through it? Let's go player by player.
Let's do it. Evander Kane, and kind of as we're going, I'll look up their contracts so we can kind of at least be a bit informed in that. I do know Evander Kane is a UFA at the end of the year. He, I think, is the type of player that will bring an immediate impact. And I think we can almost isolate this, or break down this list, not isolate, break it down into a couple different tiers. And I think the very top tier is going to be Evander Kane and Max Pacioretty. These are guys that will cost you a fair amount to bring in. Max Pacioretty is actually under contract for, was it one more season?
Another season. Yeah.
Another season. $4.5 million. And Evander Kane's under contract for this season at 5.25, but like I've kind of said in the past, cap hit
it won't be all of it. Yeah.
Yeah. So those two guys, I think, make an immediate impact and make the team a whole lot deeper. The issue is, what do you have to give up? It's going to have to be, I think the rumor floating around on both of them, I think, is probably, I think, a player, prospect, and a pick. So it would have to be, I don't know, throwing this out there, if we're going to consider Nick Ritchie a player plus a prospect, like maybe a Max Jones plus a first-round pick, something like that. Ooh, I think is
you're not going to make a lot of Ducks fans happy.
No, but I'm just saying that's kind of what it's going to take. So are you comfortable giving up that much? I think it depends on where you're at. I think personally, in my opinion, you do what you need to do to give the team the best chance to win the Cup this year and next year. And I think I've kind of gone on record on this podcast saying that, where you're in the Cup window right now.
Like, it doesn't really matter what these guys look like in 5 years. All of the Ducks, I mean, the top paid guys are not going to be, if they're around in 5 years, they won't be the players they are this season or even next season.
And it's not like there's anyone coming up in the pipeline. As much as I like Sam Steele as a player, you don't have that top line center. You don't have a dominant forward coming up.
He's a second line center.
Yes, 100%.
That's where if he best case, I think.
Yes.
Okay, but let's do a little ranking then. So we're gonna go. I'm gonna quickly run you through this list here.
I forgot about Mike Hoffman completely. I put him on that tier also.
So if you were to tier this out, like, let's say guys you want the most versus guys you want the least, I'll just kick it off here. So the guys that I think I would want the most, sorry, I'm dying over here. Mike Hoffman and Max Pacioretty, to me, are very high up the list. For the Ducks specifically, though, I think Evander Kane makes a lot of sense. I think Mike Hoffman makes a lot of sense. Max Pacioretty's probably a little lower, but he's easily the best player of those three.
Yeah.
I think if you're looking for a purely offensive, you know, type, like playmaker, shooter type, you know, Hoffman and Kane might be more in that category. Whereas Pacioretty is just more of a 5-on-5 beast who can score prolifically. So I don't know. But then on the other end of the spectrum, you have guys like Michael Grabner, Thomas Vanek. I would not be as interested in those guys. Although I know that, Grabner's, it's well documented now that he's one of the fastest players in the league and he can score in bunches. I just, I don't know if I see that one as much. And then as far as Thomas Vanek, I just don't see a role for him on this team. I mean, as we've talked about, this power play looks pretty good right now. I mean, do you really want to give up assets to make your second unit marginally better? I mean, at that point, you're really on the fringes in terms of value. So that's kind of where I see that group.
It all depends on what you give up for Vanek. I think Vanek, if it takes a third-round pick, let's say, I think that's a decent pickup. And I think he can make you – he's never going to be good in the defensive zone, but he scores. And so it all depends on where he gets utilized, what line he gets thrown on. I think if that's a guy you put with Henrique and Perry, I'm going to pass hard on that. I don't think that helps at all with the team. But I think he can make some sort of an impact and have a positive impact. If the price is right, I wouldn't hate it. But it's the price is really key there. I think if we're just purely looking at guys I'd want the most, I think in terms of the system the Ducks play, I feel like Evander Kane would fit the system the best. I think he plays the style of game that the Ducks play. He's a big, heavy wing.
I think Pacioretty, you could put Pacioretty in there too, because Pacioretty's kind of a grinder. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, Pacioretty plays a lot like, if I were to compare him to someone on the Ducks, I mean, he's kind of like Corey Perry in a way in that he a lot of his game is down low.
Okay.
But he's also good off the rush, but he's definitely more of like a grinder type, I guess.
Yeah. And I think Hoffman is a guy I'd really like. I just don't know if the Ducks would be looking at him. I don't know if
value is at league wide. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think we kind of hit on all of those names pretty good right there. We could touch on the Nicholas Jalmerson idea that kind of caught fire a bit on Twitter. Some people liked it, some people didn't. I think after sitting on it more, after we talked about it on, what was that, Friday? I like it more and more the more I think about it.
Really?
I think it's the perfect move. Because let me just throw this out there for you. I did a little bit of digging, not a whole lot, but a little bit here. Who do you think Nicholas Jalmerson played with in Chicago?
Are you talking about last season?
For the past, I went about two or three seasons back. So, gosh, who did he play most of his minutes with over that period of time?
I should know this. Shit. Oh, crap. I swore on a podcast. First time. Sorry, guys. We do have the explicit rating, I think. Dang. This is killing me here. Duncan Keith. Did he play with Keith?
He played with Duncan Keith majority of his minutes.
Look at that.
Is a left-handed defenseman that is mobile and goes up and down the ice, and we'll get back.
And sounds like someone we know.
I'm not saying that Cam Fowler is as good as Duncan Keith, but if we're going to compare a player in the league to Cam Fowler, I think Duncan Keith is a pretty fair comparable.
I love watching Duncan Keith play.
Yeah. So I think you bring him in, he slots in with Fowler, he takes up those minutes. I think that pairing could be great. It gives you two awesome and dominant defense pairings. And I think the only issue you have, and this was something a lot of people were kind of talking to me about, is then it forces Montour to play on his offside to play with a Kevin Bieksa. And I think that's
Not ideal.
But if you are utilizing them as a third pairing purely, I don't think that's a bad thing. And I think you have Montour as a power play specialist in that moment.
Yeah, I mean, look, Jalmerson would definitely address a pretty glaring need right now. So to kind of bring it back to this, since we're talking about needs and, like, you know, what would you trade? I brought it up on Twitter yesterday. But, you know, there's been a lot of talk about do you trade Jacob Larsson? You know, is he a guy you can include in a deal and feel good about it? And I did a little digging. I mean, AHL numbers are not the most available. Yeah. But there is a great website, prospect-stats.com, and pulled up some info. I mean, a lot of it is kind of surface level, but Larson's numbers are really good this season in San Diego. He's producing at a good clip at even strength. The goals percentage is insane when he's on the ice. It's at like 62%. The only thing the only thing that gives me pause is that he is, I don't know what metric they use, but for a quality of competition, he is, like, dead last among goals defensemen. Well, so I don't know if that means – because I think he was hurt to start the season.
Yes.
And they kind of eased him – they eased him back in. But I don't know. I mean, like, I just feel like if you're a blue-chip prospect, you would want to see him higher up there. But I don't know. Like, I'm not sure what to make of that. Like, I just feel like it contextualizes it a little bit, I guess.
Yeah. I mean – someone actually kind of brought this up to me when I had mentioned Jalmerson, and they had brought up that what about Larsson coming up and getting a shot? Because since coming back from injury, I think the number that they gave me, because like you said, availability of stats isn't the best ever in the minors. And I think it was Steve Hawking at S Hawking 911 brought up, I'm trying to find it. He is a +8 over that span since he came up, and that's over the past month. And so plus minus, granted, not the best stat, but he's been on the ice for more goals for than against over the past month since, and that's since coming back from injury. So, and he also said that he found a YouTube interview of him over from about a month ago saying he's finally fully healthy. And so since then, his numbers have been great.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's... like there's a lot of competing factors there. But anyway, I feel like seeing all of that made me, I guess, slightly more comfortable with the idea of trading him, because it's just nothing quite yet that I'm seeing. I'm like, all right, this guy's a surefire lock to be a stud top four guy, although that is the rap on him still, so we'll see. All right, let's – I feel like we should wrap it up here. Anything else you want to dive into before
I was just going to add in real quick, because at GC Ducks Fan kind of brings up in the Mixler chat, hate for Montour to be the odd man out because Lodi knows that RC won't sit Kevin, Boge would, but how much would he sit? I think realistically Bojemay would become the seventh defenseman. I think that's what he was brought in to be. He was the guy that was being scratched when Vatanen was healthy. I think what we'd see if they, for instance, went out and got a Jalmerson, I think you'd see Bojemay be the guy, the odd man out most nights with Bieksa, maybe Montour even, which I wouldn't be too happy about, but sitting every once in a while for Bojemay to come into the lineup. But I'm pretty sure when the Ducks signed him, he had said that he wasn't expecting to play every game. And he was kind of expecting to play in the beginning and signed on to help the team in the beginning, but was more just there to do whatever was needed to help the team out.
Right. Yeah, but it would appear like he's kind of settled into a very regular role.
Is that due to necessity or because of coach's decision, though? I guess that's where this comes down to.
Oof. Well, I feel like, I mean, you have a guy in Corbinian Holzer who is healthy and is ready to play, who basically never sees the ice.
While you have guys, Holzer never appears.
Yeah. We're still unsure if he truly exists. But there's also guys in the minors. Jacob Megna had a good stretch early in the season. You know, Larson at some point. You would expect to see him in the NHL. Marcus Pettersson, I mean, but this is kind of going way down the list. It's not like there's a lack of guys who could be the sixth defenseman or whatever. So I don't know. I think Randy Carlyle really likes Francois Beauchemin, likes the veteran thing, whatever, the leader grit. I don't know. I think it's a coach's decision more than anything.
One thing I want to add, I just remembered. No, they're not going to trade for anyone at the trade deadline because you know what? American hero Troy Terry is going to step in right after the Olympics.
Oh, you're sticking to that, eh?
Staying on it.
At least you're consistent with your bits. Let's see if we got anything else here in the Mixler chat. Oh, yeah.
Kings won.
Shatch. Oh, well, I guess that's not great for the Ducks. Nope. Shatch brings up Ian Cole is available. A good defensive D man.
Pass.
I am not the most high on Ian Cole.
Nope. Pass.
He's okay. We have that already.
The Ducks have that exactly. In Bieksa.
Oh, I don't know about that. I really think Bieksa is like worse than anyone.
That's fair.
And he looked terrible tonight.
He's looked terrible all season.
Yeah, man. But anyway, so like, yeah, I don't love Ian Cole, but like, he would be an upgrade. I actually remember hearing about Ian Cole, I think it was last year, that in terms of the micro stats, he's very good in terms of zone exits. So, doesn't really manifest itself in his like shot differentials, but I guess it's some little thing to note there. Thank you to GC Ducks Fan for that update, by the way, for the scoreboard watch. All right, we got anything else, or are we done here?
I think we're pretty good. I think we've hit everything we want to hit on.
Yeah, solid week at the AC Pod here, fourth podcast of the week, and we still have things to talk about, so clearly something is going right. We have a bit of a lighter schedule next week, just so everyone knows. We have a game on Tuesday. We'll have a show on Tuesday post-Rangers. That game is at 7 p.m. at Honda Center. And then Thursday night, we have Ducks versus Jets at Honda Center, which should be – I'm very much excited for that game because the Jets –
should be a fun one.
I haven't gotten to watch enough of them this season, season where they finally – like. Gotten it right, because I've been one of those guys, like a lot of people, it's kind of like every year I'm like, all right, the Jets are going to be great, and doesn't happen. So we got Shouch one, sorry we missed that question, you've asked it like five times. Our bad. Max Domi, hype prospect, lost a little value, still young,
for what he's gonna cost, not worth it.
Yeah, like it's
he has three goals. he has 3 goals this season, and I think he's playing 20 minutes a night.
He's a fine player, but I'm not like, pass. it's a fair question though, because he did have a lot of value early in his career, but right now I wouldn't want to really give anything up for him outside of like a late round pick, which they would never accept anyway. But yeah, as far as the schedule this week goes, Tuesday against the Rangers, Thursday against the Jets, so two interesting teams. And then this weekend is the All-Star game, right?
Yes, it is.
So only 2 shows from us next week. I don't think we're going to do anything for the All-Star game. Maybe we could. Who knows? Ricardo Cal, All-Star.
I'd rather do something after the skills competition than the actual All-Star game if we're going to do something.
Oh, I can't. I actually am a fan of the skills competition.
I like the skills competition.
I like it way more than the actual game.
Well, sorry. As we are wrapping up, I'll bring this up. Did you see that they're changing up the skills competition this year? They have a couple new events that they're going to roll out that some of them have leaked. So one of them is, instead of the typical hit the target event where you just get to pick one and you shoot and try to knock off 4.
A light pops up, right?
A light pops up and you have to hit the one that's lit up. And I like it.
Yeah. No, that's awesome. I like that. I mean, it's a very small thing, but it's cool.
Yeah.
So, any other changes?
I think they're testing a bunch of them, but they haven't actually.
Yeah, Elliot Friedman has hinted at it. He's teased us with it.
I think they're trying to do a couple different like weird relay type of stuff. I don't know. I enjoy it because the All-Star game is the All-Star game. It's gonna be somewhat boring at times. I think using 3-on-3 has helped it a bit.
Yeah, the tournament format has helped, but it's still a gimmick.
Yeah, I think at the end of the day, a skills competition is fun because you're able to see these guys do weird things and do things that you don't get to see every game. And I think it allows you to actually see how skilled they are. And I think that's part of the fun.
Yeah. I mean, to me, it's like you said, the All-Star game is to celebrate the stars of the game. It's to celebrate the talent in the league, and you want to be able to show it, you know, as much as you can. And that's why I think my favorite one is probably, I mean, a couple of years back when they first started the breakaway challenge, I thought it was great. You know, and Corey Perry busting out the mini stick.
Yeah.
I thought that was awesome. It's kind of died down a little bit, but I do love that. I love when the guys get to be a little bit more creative, show off their personalities.
They're not doing that anymore.
Yeah, hardest shot I also really like. Although they made it really weird last year. Like, there was a new system, whatever. And then accuracy contest is great. Fastest skater is awesome. Because you get to see just how fast these guys are. But yeah, it should be a fun event. Still kind of mind-boggling that John Gibson didn't make it. But yeah, it should be fun. I don't think we'll be doing anything for that. I was going to ask you, what do you think about... So I was watching this interview the other night with... it was from like last year with the NHL 100 celebration, but they had a round table with Mario Lemieux, Wayne Gretzky, Mark Messier, Bobby Orr. And Bobby Orr's bringing up how like for the All-Star game, he was bringing up an All-Star game. And that year... They had, like, you didn't play, it wasn't All-Stars versus All-Stars, it was the All-Stars versus the reigning champs.
Yeah.
And I kind of like that, although it would never happen today.
Sorry to piggyback on that a bit, but have you seen what the ECHL is doing for their All-Star game this year?
No.
So the ECHL, I've kind of heard this reported couple different places. I forgot what city's hosting it, but whatever city's hosting it, they're doing a four-team format. I think it's 4-team, maybe it's 6, something along those lines. But essentially they're doing a 3-on-3 tournament, similar to what the NHL is doing. But the home team, I think it's the Toledo Walleyes, they will have two different 3-on-3 teams that consist of however many players they have that will go along with all the different All-Star teams. So I think that it's either one for each conference or one for each division.
So the host city has its team.
Has its own and 2 separate teams. I think... In that
Can you imagine if the Tampa Bay Lightning had a 3-on-3 team?
So for the ECHL, I think it's fantastic because that thing's not going to be televised. That is simply there for those home team fans. So why not get what they want, get every player from their team going in it, and have them go up against the best team or best guys from all the other teams? I think the NHL is a little bit different. I think you want to have all the best players there. I think having a only Tampa Bay team would kind of go against the spirit of the All-Star game, in a sense. That's just my two cents.
But it would be fun, though.
It would be. And I
like,
think it
Can you imagine the line of Stamkos, Kucherov going against you know, Crosby and Ovechkin or something. Like, I don't know. It'd be pretty, I mean, we're going to kind of see it anyway.
I was about to say, aren't we going to get that anyways?
Yeah, I guess I misspoke there a little bit. But yeah, like, I think it would just be fun. I like the idea of the kind of putting the pressure on the champs. But yeah, anyway, I'm a fan of the All-Star game. I usually take a little nap, like, at some point during the game. But it's fun. It is what it is.
Yeah.
All right. I think that'll do it for tonight's show. Like we mentioned here, two games coming this week and then a little All-Star weekend action. So, fun week. A little lighter on the schedule after this four-game stretch here. That'll do it for tonight's show. As always, please rate and review the show on iTunes. Help us climb on up those rankings. And we are on SoundCloud, soundcloud.com/ACpod. Give us a follow there if you are not on iTunes. As always, AnaheimCalling.com, at AnaheimCalling on Twitter for all your Ducks content needs. Jake is on Twitter, at RainierGames91. Rankings came out today. Came out today?
They did.
I have yet to check them out, but can you tease a little bit?
It's the rivalries are in the Ducks' history, and let's just say this. The Kings aren't the five-star. It's the Red Wings.
Oh, it's rivalries. Oh, I can't wait to see this. Okay. Ooh. All right. Yeah. So check that out. Good stuff from Jake, as always. I'm on Twitter at Felix_Sicard. My defenseman and goalie letter grades are coming out this week, so be on the lookout for that. And that will do it for tonight's show. We will talk to you Tuesday night after the Rangers game. Jake will be out that night, so I might get CJ, might get someone else. We will see, but you will not be hearing from Jake until at least next Thursday.
Sorry, guys. Anyway,
just a little note there. But yeah, we will talk to you Tuesday night. See you soon.
Bye.